Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, I'm Jane Richards on the New Books in Law, a channel on the New Books Network. Today, I'm talking to Assistant Professor at the University of Nottingham, Andreas Fulda. Dr. Fulda has published widely in both English, Chinese, and German. He's a Senior Fellow at the University of Nottingham Asia Research Institute. In his research, he specializes in democratization studies, leverage in the public, private, and social sector, citizen diplomacy, as well as EU-China relations. He's worked in China NGOs on capacity-building projects for Chinese civil society. He regularly appears on and in major international media sources such as Al Jazeera, The Times, and France 24. Today, I'm speaking to Andreas about his new book, The Struggle for Democracy in Mainland China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong, Sharp Power and Its Discontents, published by Routledge earlier this year. Andreas, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
I'm wondering if we can start off, if you just wouldn't mind telling me a little bit about yourself and how you came to write The Struggle for Democracy in Mainland China and Taiwan.
Sure. Well, this book has been 10 years in the making, so to speak. But actually, when I drafted the preface, I realized it's actually been a journey that's taken me 30 years, so to speak. And I was just thinking back, you know, how comes that I became interested in all things Chinese? And in a way, it all kind of dates back to 1989. That's when I was, 12 years old. That's, of course, the year when the pro-democracy and anti-corruption movement in mainland China was suppressed. So I saw that kind of beamed into our living room. Back then, we lived in Geneva. And that left a deep impression on me. And just the day after June 4th, there was another spectacle. An American-born Taiwanese, Michael Chang, progressed to the final in the Paris Open. And I hadn't paid much attention to Asia at all, whether it was China or Taiwan or any other part of the Asian region. And I was really into tennis. And so in a very quick succession, I got a taste of Asia. And one was, of course, the shocking pictures that we saw from Tiananmen Square. And the other one was quite different. It was a young, Michael Chang, succeeding against all odds against back then, Lendl, who was the number one. And I really admired him for that. And so these kind of two opposite kind of emotional reactions to Asia have stayed with me, so to speak, a disgust for, authoritarian, arbitrary kind of rule, but also like an admiration for, the work ethic and, the entrepreneurialism and, the fighting spirit of Asian people. And so, yeah, I guess that kind of informs my worldview, so to speak. And and as you said, I've been like working in China for many years. I've studied China, and so I always try to combine both theory and practice in my work. And so this book is also an embodiment of that.
And I do think you really capture that in the book, both the theory side, and it is grounded very well in the literature and the scholarship, but also with so many practical examples, some firsthand and also from the wider historical events. And so combining, you know, a bit of what you've just said about, you know, on the one hand, these kind of this arbitrary rule and authority displayed by China, and then on the other hand, the work ethic of entrepreneurialism and fighting spirit of people in Asia and in this region, I think this relates to what you call the research puzzle at the heart of this book. And you said that it's to what extent political activists in mainland China, Taiwan and Hong Kong have made progress in their quest to liberalize and democratize their respective policies. Mm-hmm. Can you speak a little bit about the overarching theme and the overarching research question of the book?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I mean, what I've learned over the past 15 years is that, you know, good theory is derived from practice, and good practice is informed by theory. And here I'm very much influenced by John Dewey, Donald Schön. You know, these are philosophers and pragmatists who have always tried to combine those two worlds. And what I've noticed over the years is also that there is this real disconnect between academia on the one hand and the world of the activists on the other. And I don't think it can be that, you know, academics just study democracy and then think that it is somehow the job of others to struggle for it. Now, of course, I don't suggest that someone who's been primarily reading books and analyzing, you know, research puzzles should be at the forefront necessarily of, protests and getting tear gassed like in Hong Kong.
Yeah, I can imagine that, yes.
But I do think that we need to narrow this gap because in a way what I found is that democratization studies overall as an academic field is very backward looking and unable to predict democratic changes in the future. And so my interest was really to see what politically active citizens in mainland Chinatown, Hong Kong, are doing to advance democratic reforms. And that is something that needs to be done empirically. We need to talk to them. We need to engage with them. We need to live with them to see how they make sense of it all. This has been kind of like my research interest for a very, very long time, and this is now the culmination and the result of it.
Yeah, and that does come through. You do situate the theory very well in and around these key historical events. And so I think it's quite relevant now to ask you, turning to China, you know, you talk about mainland China's incomplete modernization, and that you say that since 1945, China has made some advances in modernization, mm-hmm. but this has happened without social equality, without transparency or accountability, and in the absence of an independent, assertive civil society. And that's arguably meant that corruption, collusion, and nepotism have spread from the elite to the mass level. Now, I'm wondering if you can describe this process of modernization and how this is limited in the mainland.
Yes, sure. I mean, modernization theory, although it's been in a way discredited and refuted many times over, in the case of mainland China, actually, it's been a very powerful kind of lens that people have used. But of course, now people are waking up to the fact that it doesn't really apply. Because in a nutshell, the idea was that a country that becomes more affluent, develops a middle class, which is, you know, moderately well off and educated, that such a society would liberalize and democratize. Now, that's, of course, not what we've seen in mainland China. At least that process hasn't been a complete success. And so what I try to express here is that, yes, you do, of course, now have a nascent middle class. People in the cities in mainland China are relatively better off. Many now own property, for example, and can afford to travel abroad, etc. But if you look at the political economy overall, we see a very different picture. And here we then need to talk about the party, and we need to talk about systemic and endemic corruption and how it has actually spilled over into the public domain. There's actually almost like a turning point, almost the couple of years before WTO accession. I think there was a real momentum for reform. If you just think back to the era of Jiang Zemin, Zhu Rongji, some real structural reforms took place. So Zhu Rongji actually managed to unify the domestic market, which was a major achievement, or Jiang Zemin managed to kind of push back the People's Liberation Army, which had become like a state within the state. But in a way, after WTO accession, after 2001, various interest groups, they consolidated their power, and they started to almost capture the party state. And we haven't really seen much structural reform since. And this kind of consolidation of these interest groups has meant that, now we can see, corruption entering stratospheric dimensions, really, which make everything that we've seen in the West in terms of large-scale corruption, dwarf, really. I mean, some of the examples are, really staggering.
I think that also it comes through, and it relates to some of the other points that you make. For example, the politics of China, it's now become this, you describe it as a winner-takes-all conception of politics. Mm-hmm. And you say also that the party state since 1989 has started to radically move back and forth between the role of a developmental and a predatory state. Can you talk more about this? Is that related to corruption broadly?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think I provide this example of the milk scandal of 2008. Now, this is not new, strictly speaking, but very often people only look at just partial aspects of it. It actually can reveal a simultaneous state and market failure. So basically what we have here is a scandal where a lot of Chinese citizens get sick, and especially their children develop kidney stones because of unsafe milk formula. And so what's the problem here? The dairy industry sets a very low standard for milk nutrition levels because they want to sell more milk. The state goes along with that, but then realizes they would actually like to have more nutritious milk. So just to explain that, if let's say I drink a glass of milk here in the UK, in terms of nutrition levels, you would have to drink two glasses of milk in mainland China to reach the same levels. So what do they then do as a kind of a workaround? They ask Chinese scientists to develop ways to increase nutrition levels. But they then add melamine to these milk products, which is highly problematic because it's dangerous for human consumption. And so we see here then Chinese scientists assisting the party state on the one hand, but also then working with the dairy industry basically produce milk that is unsafe for human consumption. And when actually that scandal broke and we saw that more than 300,000 people got ill six Chinese babies died, actually the party state suppressed all these news They silence the victims and they try to kind of sweep everything under the carpet. And, you know, we're still dealing with this scandal today because if you are in Australia, New Zealand, Canada, or the UK for that matter, you will occasionally see that, for example, Chinese students go to a supermarket to buy baby formula. And because the demand has been so high, often supermarkets now restrict them to buy 2 packs of baby formula. And they then send that to China, either to their relatives or they try to make a little bit of money on their side by just, you know, it's just kind of a business. And so until today, you know, this problem hasn't been solved. And a lot of mainland Chinese consumers don't trust, you know, their own, you know, Chinese brands. And, you know, if, you know, that shows us that, you know, a very real problem of food safety hasn't been solved in the past 12 years.
Yeah, actually, anecdotally, I can attest to that. I moved to the mainland a few years after 2008, and I had my first baby there. And the price of formula, because everyone only wants to buy imported formula, is just exorbitant. And there are still restrictions on taking how much formula you can take in. So it really is, you know, and there are other kind of things that are continually covered up, which is really concerning in relation to food safety specifically.
Well, and you see, I mean, having scandals, I mean, we've had food safety scandals in the West as well, of course, and, you know, things like that can happen. But if we have market failure, a regulatory state has to step in, kind of beef up the regulations and oversight. That's what we would normally expect from our governments. But in the case of mainland China, that's just clearly not happening. And it is not happening because of the political economy, because of the, you know, lack of media freedoms. And so, you know, it does matter, you know, whether you have a one-party state, a dictatorship, or something, yeah, more of a, you know, a liberal democratic setup based on the rule of law, because that actually allows us to solve such problems.
Yeah, and I think that relates to my next question, actually. You give a lot of background on the CCP's rise to power and the resulting the trinity of party, government, and the military. Mm-hmm. Can you talk more about this broadly?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's quite hard to kind of like summarize, you know, a complex subject as the Chinese Communist Party in a couple of sentences. But let me try nevertheless. Like in China, we call this trinity Dang, Zheng, Jun, meaning like Dang is the party, Zheng the government, and Jun the military. Now, we can kind of unpack this, you know, one by one. The fact of the matter is that the party controls the state. So that's why we call it a party state, meaning that all these emblems of the state, in a way, are it's just like a charade. Ultimately, everything boils down to the Communist Party. And interestingly, under Xi Jinping, we've seen the party come out of the shadows and it's become much more visible. This is a big change to, let's say, 10 years ago, even 20 years ago, when the party was, of course, visible, but much more hidden. And Richard McGregor has written about that in his excellent book, The Party. And the party, of course, also controls the military, because if the military is not loyal to the party, then, you know, the party is in peril. And so that also explains why Xi Jinping has paid so much attention to kind of make sure that the generals are loyal, not just to the party, but also to himself. But, you know, from a democratization perspective, such a setup is, of course, highly problematic, because if, you know, state institutions are not independent from one party control, it's very hard to liberalize, because basically the party is hardwired into all of these state institutions. And the other very big problem is, of course, if the military is politically invested, it is always possible that in the process of liberalization, democratization, the military may step in and say, you know, that's all, you know, you politicians may want to do that, but we will not allow you to do that. And so these are big, you know, two big obstacles, the party state, you know, party being hardwired into the state structure, and of course, the role of the military.
And just building on that, you know, this idea of corruption and then the fear that the military may step in, you talk about this rule by bribery and rule by fear. Can you expand upon how these have actually been applied in the mainland?
Sure. I mean, rule by bribery, rule by fear, it's basically the way I describe, you know, the carrots and sticks that the Chinese Communist Party uses. Because, of course, anyone who's dealt with China, Chinese politics is aware it's not all just draconian suppression of public, sentiment and public demands. It's a bit more subtle. Suppression does play a role. But the carrots, for example, are, of course, equally important. And so the party state has used patronage and associated privileges to generate loyalty to the CCP. And so in more practical terms, they have co-opted business people and other professionals. So think of university lecturers, for example, who get preferential, access to housing and other benefits, for example. But they've co-opted business people and other professionals, not just within China, but also outside China, into the party state orbit to neutralize, social groups that could potentially come into conflict with the party. And the carrots are being used so strategically that, for example, let's say there is a local community where there are local grievances. Let's say, there's a development project that Chinese citizens don't like, or an environmental, disaster has struck and people want compensation, etc. They literally use money to pacify these conflict-capable groups in Chinese society. It's very costly. But just think from, their point of view, using the people armed police to beat up people, to imprison people, etc. That is also costly. There's a real, price tag on suppression. So if actually bribing people or paying people off is cheaper, the Communist Party will do that. But it's a kind of case by case. So this is like the carrots, the rule by bribery aspect. And then, of course, you have still the rule by fear. And, I can talk you through. I mean, there are five dimensions to that, and it's a rather extensive list.
But it is very real. I think drawing these points together, is your argument is essentially that you say the securitization of mainland China under Xi Jinping since 2012 should actually be seen as a sign of profound weakness of an embattled regime. So I'm wondering, and you also say that it's not an exaggeration to surmise that throughout the 20th century, every family in mainland China has been victimized by the CCP in one way or the other. I'm wondering, how vulnerable is mainland China's party state?
Well, I mean, let's look, for example, at rule by fear, and then we see, how vulnerable they really are. I mean, they are so suspicious of their own people. Maybe I can start with a very short anecdote. I once spoke with a local government official, actually in his office, so I can reveal the gender. I remember vividly, this gentleman leaning over and saying to me, Andreas, what the problem is? The Communist Party doesn't trust the Chinese people. And I was really struck, back then that, this individual was so willing to say that, actually in his office, it's rather unusual given that I'm not Chinese. But you can see, for example, this, the manifestation of this mistrust is, of course, the personal file system. So every Chinese individual has a Dang'an where everything is being noted from, cradle to grave, from the kindergarten to school, to the university, and then, you know, the professional life. And having a file on oneself is, of course, it disciplines, because you don't really know what's going in there because you can't read it. It's not like available where you can say, I would like to see my case. And now they're developing this personal file system into the social credit system, which is a way to micromanage the lives of Chinese people. But the problem is those individuals who are not willing to engage in self-censorship and to kind of comply and, with the party diktat, those people who, let's say there was a Chinese student who threw ink on a poster of Xi Jinping, she found herself in a psychiatric ward. So she was, against her will and against Chinese law, by the way, she was admitted to into the psychiatric system. And, others like petitioners, for example, they would end up in labor camps, re-education camps, so-called black jails, etc. So this is another kind of indication how fearful actually Communist Party is of its people. And then you have the strike hard campaigns, you have the incarceration of the more than 1.5 million Uyghurs and Kazakhs. You have this constant emphasis on rigid stability, trying to kind of nip everything in the bud. And very often, in order to kind of maintain this stability, now local governments actually use thugs for hire to beat up people. So we see the rise of local mafia states as well. And all these are signs of not a confident Chinese Communist Party, but actually of one that feels vulnerable, which is under threat. Because if the party was confident, it wouldn't need to use the sticks. It wouldn't need to constantly rule by fear. So in a way, the rise of the security state, because you mentioned that, to me is a sign of weakness, not a sign of strength.
Yeah, and that certainly comes out. And just to put in context, because, I mean, the book is called Democracy in Mainland China. So there are democracy activists and people advocating for democracy in China. And you draw out what you see as the key episodes in the Chinese democracy movement, being the 1989 Nationwide Anti-Corruption and Pro-Democracy Movement, or the Tiananmen Massacre, the 1998 failed attempt to establish the China Democracy Movement, the Charter 08, which you say is the grand strategy of the mainland democracy movement, and then China's New Citizen Movement. Can you talk a little bit about the lessons that democracy activists have learned, and any reflections and the way forward, do you think, for democracy in the mainland?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I mean, in a way, two of these, well, one could say actually three of these episodes where, they didn't achieve what they set themselves out to achieve. So 1989, of course, was suppressed. The attempt to establish the China Democracy Party also failed. And, Charter 08, of course, although it's a very significant breakthrough for the mainland Chinese democracy movement, also wasn't, signed by millions of people, but probably the number of signatories was, didn't exceed, 10,000 people. But nevertheless, these are still kind of milestones in the development of mainland Chinese democracy movement. And in particular, the New Citizen Movement is actually very intriguing and potentially transformative movement, which has the potential to help liberalize mainland China's political system. But it really depends how we want to talk about it, because like each episode deserves its own kind of treatment. But if you ask me about, the kind of, in a nutshell, what I see when looking at all four episodes is perhaps on a very highly, you know, aggregate and abstract level, what we can see is, a slow progress towards an explicit formulation of an ultimate goal of ending one-party rule. Because, for example, in 1989, the students, the workers, also the intellectuals, and the common people who joined this movement, they were not necessarily aiming to overthrow the Communist Party. And even in 1998, the China Democracy Party actually they kind of positioned themselves as what they called a loyal opposition. It didn't work out. The Communist Party didn't trust them, and they also nipped this attempt to build an opposition party in the bud. And so it took until 2008 with the Charter 08 for the democracy movement to make it very clear, yes, they want to end one-party rule. And this really has, it underlines that, oppression is domesticating. So maybe for you and I and others as outsiders, it was always clear, well, how can China liberalize and democratize with the Chinese Communist Party in power? But if you're actually a Chinese citizen, to get to that point to say, well, maybe we can't achieve this objective with the Communist Party in power, that is a big, big step. And it does take a long time to draw this conclusion. Yeah, and since 2008, this is kind of like almost the consensus in the mainland Chinese democracy movement. And with the New Cities Movement, they've been trying to actually work towards that goal.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And I think now that's a good time to start talking about Taiwan, perhaps, because similarly, it is comparable that it took a really long time for the Taiwan democracy movement to overcome authoritarianism by peaceful means. You said it took more than 100 years. That kind of, it did give me some hope. I'm wondering if you can talk a bit about this process and the lessons that we can learn from Taiwan, whether or not it's unique in the region, you think, or if it is comparable.
Sure. I mean, in a way, the reason why I say 100 years is that even under Japanese colonial rule, you had Taiwanese who were advocating for autonomy and self-government. But after the end of World War II and when the Nationalist Party arrived in Taiwan after they lost the Civil War, Chiang Kai-shek, of course, had no interest whatsoever in granting Taiwanese more autonomy and self-government. So after 1947, the 228 incident, we saw this very long period of white terror where literally tens of thousands of Taiwanese elites were killed or imprisoned. And it basically took until the late 1960s, early 1970s for some opposition to reemerge in the form of this Dang Wai movement outside the Nationalist Party, Dang Wai. And this movement, of course, struggled. It's very hard to challenge essentially you know, Leninist, you know, nationalist party. And they, you know, they had many setbacks. Think of the 1979 Kaohsiung incident, where many of the leading proponents were actually imprisoned. But, you know, I hone in on one particular episode of this Dangwai era, and that is the early 1980s. And it's, in a way, it can be almost compared to mainland China today. Of course, mainland China is much tougher. It's a harder nut to crack, so to speak. But in the early 1980s, we had you know, these very dark years where the opposition was suppressed. The leading proponents were in jail. And there was one individual, Kang Ningxiang. He led this movement through those dark years, and he paved the way for the founding of the Democratic Progressive Party. And I think this is a very interesting episode, because what this gentleman achieved, Kang was a self-taught, kind of almost like a social democrat from, you know, rather, you know, a poor background. Who rose through the ranks. He was very, you know, hardworking, and you could say entrepreneurial in his political advocacy as well. And what he managed to do is he kind of struck a balance between more militant factions within the opposition movement and conservatives in the ruling Nationalist Party. And what I only found out through the research of this book is he was actually on good speaking terms with the successor of Chiang Kai-shek, the son of Chiang Kai-shek, Jiang Jingguo. So they had face-to-face conversations, and somehow they trusted each other. And this was significant because although the movement was suppressed, in 1984, Kang actually took a delegation of Dangwai politicians to Washington, D.C. And here he must have struck a deal with Jiang Jingguo, so to speak, because you know, why should he allow him to go to Washington, D.C. to kind of raise the profile of the opposition, right? But the kind of the compromise was that Kang supported the Nationalist Party in a way by arguing that the United States should continue to provide weapons for the defense of Taiwan vis-a-vis China. But simultaneously, he asked the Americans to support the opposition movement. And that was very, very significant because it gave, you know, the Dangwai and later the DPP a real standing in the United States. So he internationalized the movement. He gained U.S. support for democratization. And when the DPP was founded in 1986, and this is, you know, where Taiwan really differs from mainland China, unlike the China Democracy Move, you know, the China Democracy Party, which was suppressed in 1998, Jiang Jingguo actually tolerated the DPP as long as they didn't kind of advocate independence, etc. And so this was a real breakthrough under Kang Ningxiang's leadership. And I think it's really interesting because he managed to kind of, you know, bridge, you know, the militant faction in the opposition movement. He kind of managed to engage with the autocrats. He internationalized the movement. So I think there's much to be learned from this particular episode.
That's really interesting. Another way you say that the path to democracy was forged was in relation to issues of national identity and language and cultural policies. You talk about how difference was emphasized in relation to, you know, bringing on greater democratization. Can you talk a bit more about this, please?
Yeah, sure. I mean, these days, for many reasons, people frown at identity politics because it's often kind of this us versus them kind of problematic. You know, think of the cultural wars that we've seen in the US, but increasingly also in the UK and in Europe and in other parts of the world. But I think sometimes we shouldn't take this critique too far. We don't have to support nationalist causes or particular, you know, nation building narratives by just simply acknowledging that, for example, for the Taiwanese, you know, they were not allowed to speak their language. So after the Nationalist Party arrived in Taiwan, you know, children were not just discouraged from speaking Taiwanese, but they were forbidden to do so. The kind of different historical memories of the Taiwanese were also suppressed. So parents at home had to be extremely, you know, careful that they didn't mention even like the 228 incident of 1947, because if children were to speak about that in school, this could really get the parents into trouble. So this is, you know, why they had like, they call about it, call this era like the White Terror. And so if you've been at the receiving end of state suppression, to say that, you know, I would like to speak my own language, or I would like to kind of commemorate the fallen and the victims of authoritarianism, that is a very human desire that should be respected. And so, in a way, for example, the Danwai, they had different factions. You had the more nationalist Taiwanese, for example. And you had those, let's say, modernizers who wanted liberalization, democratization as a way to solve social problems. And they were not necessarily on the same page. But you need both. You can't say one kind of, let's say, stream in the democracy camp is more important than the other. They are complementary. And so, although I'm not a great fan of nationalism, but I've also come to understand that, of course, you know, democracy activists are often patriotic you know, even nationalist. The reason is they do care about the Commonwealth. They want to improve it. They want self-government. And so if you're not patriotic, if you're not, you know, let's say mildly nationalistic, and I mean it in the most positive way possible, then why should you do all this? So I think this is understood, you know, also from the academic side, that this is a very powerful driving force.
And I think oftentimes it's quite easy, if you live in a Western liberal democracy, to forget how oppressive, you know, some governments can be and continue to be, and how restrictive that is in terms of like kind of forging any kind of path to democracy. And yet, you know, you pick out in China, in Taiwan, in Hong Kong, these key episodes where, you know, there have been steps forward despite the oppression of, say, not being able to speak your own language, or you mentioned before the domesticating oppressiveness in the mainland. I'm wondering if you can talk, you've touched on two key episodes in Taiwan, the Dangwei movement and then the formation of Taiwan's DPP party. Can you also talk about the other two key episodes you identified in 2000 to 2008, the Chen Shui-bian's two-term presidency, and then from 2008 to 16, Ma Ying-jeou's presidency as well?
Well, I think it's very interesting. I mean, this is already kind of post-liberalization, democratization. Of course, Chen Shui-bian is the first democratically elected politician of the opposition camp to serve as a president. But it kind of also is interesting for a newly democratized country like Taiwan to see some of the problems that come with the process. So the DPP kind of wins power, but it's a very difficult kind of setup because they hold on the presidency, but they didn't have a majority in parliament. So in effect, it's a split government. But because they're not on good speaking terms with the Nationalist Party, which they fought, you know, tooth and nail over the decades, and you know, they have very strong and, you know, legitimate grievances, of course, against the Nationalist Party, they can't implement their reform policies well, because how can you govern when you don't have a majority in parliament? And so in a way, Chen Shui-bian, for the two terms that he served, he had to constantly rely on all sorts of antics, symbolic politics, and essentially use a fairly manipulative kind of approach to politics to advance his and the DPP's agenda. And that's actually quite problematic, because at one point you do need to forge a consensus, especially given that Taiwan is always facing the threat of military annexation from mainland China. And so this kind of was a huge problem for Chen Shui-bian all those 8 years. And ultimately, of course, he was indicted for corruption charges and actually sent to prison, and became also a victim in a way of the DPP's reform agenda itself, because the DPP, of course, always had complained about the Nationalist Party's corruption, had kind of toughened up anti-corruption legislation, and then actually their own president fell victim to the higher standards that they themselves set. But I mean, that speaks that, you know, democratization has improved things in Taiwan, because it's possible to indict and imprison a corrupt president. Now, that's certainly something that wouldn't happen in mainland China, for example. And if we talk about Ma Ying-jeou, it's quite interesting. Those 8 years, they are problematic for another reason, because when people were fed up with Chen Shui-bian after those 8 years, they gave Ma Ying-jeou, you know, a resounding victory in 2008. And he had a majority in parliament, so in a way he could govern. But he kind of took this mandate to mean that he could just push aside the DPP in a semi-authoritarian way, you could say. And he also didn't reach out across the aisle. He tried to reverse much of the kind of reforms that the DPP had implemented. And in particular on the national identity issue, we could see that, okay, Chen Shui-bian was pushing for a more like, for greater like, you know, a Taiwan, you know, a distinctive Taiwanese identity. And then Ma Ying-jeou just went in the opposite direction. And predictably, you know, that would create a huge tension, which then resulted in social movements, in the Sunflower Movement. And then actually, after 8 years, of course, the DPP, regained the presidency with President Tsai and also won a majority in the legislative yuan in the parliament. So it's quite interesting to see that after liberalization, democratization, you know, started 1986 and throughout the 1990s, when you look at the electoral landscape, it's really volatile, and you see these huge swings to, you know, in either direction. But yeah, it has now resulted in the presidency of Tsai Ing-wen, and she was just re-elected. So we do see now some form of consolidation, one could argue. But it also again speaks, you know, to the fact that, yeah, we have to think about democratization processes in decades, not in years.
Yeah, and I think actually that's a really interesting time then to talk about Hong Kong, because, you know, on the one hand, we've got China, who's still a very strict authoritarian regime, and then on the other hand is Taiwan, which has gone through this very long process of democratization. And, you know, Benny Tai, has the Hong Kong scholar, has described the Hong Kong moving from a position of semi-democracy to semi-authoritarianism. So then just going back a little, just to put Hong Kong into a bit of context in this kind of struggle for democracy, can you talk firstly a little bit about pre-1997 Hong Kong under British colonial rule, and Chris Patten, the Hong Kong's last governor, trying to put in these liberalisation reforms from the top down? Do you think it was a case of too little too late before the hand over back to China, or did that help democracy in Hong Kong?
Yeah, I think Hong Kong is a very curious case. And so far, we've spoken about mainland China and Taiwan. And of course, in both cases, we have, you know, the successors of, you know, the two parties that were involved in the civil war, the Chinese Communist Party and the Nationalist Party, yeah, calling the shots as the kind of the ruling parties, the governing parties. Now, in the case of Hong Kong, of course, because it's, you know, it was indeed a British colony, there were actually as early as 1946, there were, you know, British politicians who thought that perhaps they should introduce political reform and move towards a more representative system. So Mark Young actually kind of came up with reform ideas to give the local population greater self-government. But eventually these plans were shelved in part because they were worried that the British were worried that if they were to open up the political arena in Hong Kong, this may give the Chinese Communist Party on the mainland and the Nationalist Party from Taiwan kind of almost like a proxy to continue to battle it out in terms of like this unresolved civil war. And, of you know, in hindsight, this is a mistake. They should have introduced democracy to Hong Kong much earlier, but they didn't. And so only in the 1980s, when it became clear that Hong Kong would indeed be returned under, you know, and come under PRC sovereignty, only then they started kind of thinking about, okay, how can we make the legislative council more representative, have more direct elections, etc. And that's, in a way, why I argue it's been too little too late. But, you know, to Chris Patten's credit, I mean, he tried to do as much as he could under the given circumstances. And of course, the problem is whatever he introduced in terms of reforms could be reversed after the handover. And this was actually articulated by the Chinese Communist Party. They constantly warned him when, you know, taking reforms that he must not go too far. So I think he also worked under, you know, extreme limitations. And so although he seems in recent interviews, in recent years, he seems to be regretful that he didn't do enough. I think actually under the given circumstances, he actually greatly expanded, the political liberties of the Hong Kongers.
Yeah, I think I definitely agree with you. And then so after 1997, you know, you talk a bit about this in the book about Hong Kong when it did become under PRC sovereignty. And some of the examples you give are of selective decolonization, for example, in relation to the school system, in relation to the free press, the hollowing out of already comparatively weak democratic institutions. Like you've just said that the PRC government did warn Chris Patten that they would reverse any of these liberties. Can you talk about what went on after 1997 when Hong Kong was first returned?
Sure. I think what happened really is they were mindful of public opinion. See, in 1997, that's only 8 years after Tiananmen. So the PRC, the Chinese Communist Party, was trying to reestablish itself as a credible kind of trustworthy international partner. So they didn't want to mess up that process by, imposing direct rule on Hong Kong from day one. So what they did instead is they played a very long game of selective decolonization. And you've just mentioned education, you know, press, we could add policing as well. And so the problem with this kind of, using a salami tactic of kind of slicing up, those semi-democratic, institutions in Hong Kong is that decolonization, of course, in the case of Hong Kong, doesn't mean liberalization and democratization. Yeah. Actually, it means a reversal of those steps taken under Chris Patten. And normally, I mean, I think in a discourse about colonies and decolonization, normally one would kind of welcome that from a normative standpoint, right? But in the case of Hong Kong, actually, it's exactly the opposite. It means just, you could say, a recolonization, although that term is, of course, politically charged because Hong Kong does come under PRC sovereignty that is not even disputed in the democracy camp. So it's a very special case. But in terms of like the mode of like the governance mode, we see that actually the Hong Kong SAR government had limited autonomy to begin with. And we could see as early as 2014, for example, that the liaison office of the Communist Party, you know, they played a huge role. And for example, during the Umbrella Movement, all of the crisis management didn't really happen in Hong Kong. It happened in Shenzhen. And so we do see this indirect rule of the Chinese Communist Party, which of course also manifests itself by, you know, working through other proxies, for example, the Hong Kong tycoons, who are dependent on CCP patronage. And so here we can think back to, you know, this, you know, rule by bribery, rule by fear, the carrots and sticks. You know, these Hong Kong tycoons, if they want to, you know, do business in mainland China, they are very much, you know, they have many incentives to toe the party line. And then, of course, yeah, you see all these other kind of moves towards kind of neutering the Legislative Council, hollowing out the Basic Law, you know, the broken promises on universal suffrage. And then, of course, last year's, protests against the extradition law. The writing was on the wall all those years. But I think still it was quite shocking for the outside world to see, and also perhaps for the Hong Kong democracy movement, how swift in the end the CCP moved towards restricting political and civil liberties in Hong Kong.
Yeah, and I think this leads into you describing Hong Kong as the proverbial canary in the coal mine in relation to democracy. Can you talk more about this, please, and what you mean?
I mean, I think, look, I'm in admiration for what the good people of Hong Kong have achieved over these years. They put up a really good fight under impossible circumstances, they did everything they could to prevent this slide towards autocracy. Now, having said that, I do think that if one looks at the entire process, let's say since 1997 until now, those 23 years, it's one thing to critique the Communist Party, the Hong Kong SAR government. And I think their agenda has been quite clear. But I do in my book critique the Hong Kong's democracy movement. Now, one could say that's unfair. Who am I to judge anything that's happening in Hong Kong? I'm not living there. I don't have to battle it out. But I do think as a friend of the Hong Kong democracy movement, one also has to be sober in kind of analyzing some of the, you know, one-sided strategic approaches and tactical errors that also have occurred. And I argue that actually the Pan Democrats have been underperforming since the 1997 handover. So let me just perhaps point out three things. So in my mind, for example, the Democratic Party failed to reform itself. And I'm thinking here of Martin Lee, for example. He was a very middle-class kind of modernizing reformer, almost like Kang Ningxiang. But unlike Kang Ningxiang in Taiwan, he tried to kind of keep the social movements perhaps the more radical elements of the pan-democratic camp under control by excluding them from the political party structure. And I think this is, in hindsight, this was probably a mistake, because in a democratization process, an opposition party has to align itself with social and political movements. Now, we have seen, on an ad hoc basis in the case of Hong Kong. Of course, there have been ad hoc coalitions, but they often fell apart. And so we can see this very uneasy relationship between political parties, social movements, and NGOs. And partly because the Democratic Party didn't manage to reform itself, many of the younger activists kind of left the party or formed their own party. And so we see this enormous proliferation of various parties, almost like NGOs, often with just one individual kind of representing the party, so to speak. And that, of course, undermines the the cohesion of the pan-democratic camp. If you really want to push for liberalization, democratization, you need one opposition party, one big church that can integrate all these different factions. But they didn't achieve that. And then we see the rise of localism, nativism, especially after 2014, because many of the younger activists think, well, okay, if you don't give us universal suffrage, if you don't honor one country, two systems, then, why should we focus on one country? If you don't give us two systems, then, maybe we need two countries. Maybe we need Hong Kong independence. Now, I think this is for many, many reasons very, rather difficult to achieve because you have a land border with mainland China. Hong Kong is dependent on, food and water supplies from mainland China. So, real independence, I think, would be, rather difficult to achieve. But it's not necessarily surprising that, people are fed up and frustrated with, the older pan-democrats. And this brings me to my, third point. I think because of this kind of tension in terms of the different approaches between the younger and the older activists, regardless actually of these differences, we actually see that perhaps in the case of Hong Kong, the democracy movement has actually been overly reliant on what I call this anti-establishment approach, TQY. So for example, when I spoke with my friends in Hong Kong, and I just asked, so how many people actually try to work within the system, trying to bring about reform using a Trojan horse or a trans-establishment approach, they could basically tell me one name, and one name only, Christine Loh, and she used to be a pan-democrat and representing she worked in the legislative council, but then she joined the CY Leung government working on environmental issues. And she was often described by, activists in the pan-democratic camp as a turncoat, as a sellout. But the problem with that kind of characterization is you do need people within the system who are sympathetic to your cause. They're not necessarily your allies, but at least they need to kind of within the system open the doors or argue for less, draconian countermeasures against the democracy movement. So also think of Kang Linxiang in Taiwan. He was on good speaking terms with Jiang Jingguo, and that certainly helped kind of create some political space for the Dang Wai and later the DPP to exist and flourish. But in the case of Hong Kong, we don't see that at all, really. And yes, they've been very strong in terms of street protests and social movements. And I think it's admirable. And, they're very brave. But I think on its own, I think we can now say that was not enough to bring about liberalization, democratization.
Yeah, and so I do think your critique of the Hong Kong democracy movement is fair, and it is important, and we do need to discuss these things, especially, as you say, as a friend of Hong Kong, and looking at the ways democracy, this process, can be kind of moved forward. Just kind of tying it all together, on that point, I think in your conclusion you argue that China affairs scholars should develop a critical stance towards the excesses of the CCP rule in mainland China and its periphery. Contemporary Chinese studies as a whole runs the risk of becoming complicit in the CCP's united front. Now, I'm wondering if you can just explain this, just tying everything together, and also whether you think there's a duty on China scholars, especially those outside China or Hong Kong, in relation to what they conduct their research on and how they do it?
Yeah, this is a big topic. I mean, okay, let me try to unpack this. I mean, from the vantage point of mainland Chinese, Taiwanese, and Hong Kongers, they may at times say, you know, who are you to judge us? Or, you know, like, for example, Andreas, they could say, you're German, you live and work in the United Kingdom, and you study the region. You know, what gives you the right to critique either the governing party, you know, the political oppressors, or even, you know, the democracy movement? But I think outsiders have a role to play. Our kind of view from the outside can enrich, you know, the perspectives of insiders. So I don't think is, you know, that our view is necessarily better or more accurate than the views of insiders, but it's complementary, and people can learn from our points of view. They can accept them or reject them. Now, the problem I have with sinology and contemporary Chinese studies in general is very often outsiders have gone the easy route, so to speak, and have, you know, knowingly or unknowingly affiliated themselves with, you know, the governing elites. So, for example, in the case of mainland China, there are lots of academics who by and large, follow the lead of the Chinese Communist Party in terms of the topics they select to study, the way they discuss these issues. So just to give you one example, there has been in political science, for example, a debate about the legitimacy of the Communist Party. Now, I think it's not very legitimate, but in the academic discourse, there have been academics who said, well, we shouldn't discuss, you know, the question of legitimacy. Let's have a look, you know, how effective this, you know, mode of governance is, you know, in terms of state capacity, can they deliver? And alternatively, they then have looked at the question, you know, do people in China support the Communist Party? And yes, they found out there are, of course, people who support the Communist Party, some people, you know, from the middle class in the urban areas, etc. But the problem then, in my view, is the question whether the Chinese Communist Party enjoys political legitimacy and the question whether the Chinese Communist Party has popular support, these are two different issues. And so for China specialists or sinologists to say, well, maybe, you know, the question of popular support is more important than, you know, the question of political legitimacy, this is problematic. Because I would concede, yes, you know, the Communist Party, of course, like many authoritarian regimes, has, you know, limited social, you know, societal support, but it is a totally, you know, from a democratic perspective, illegitimate government, and that is something a lot of China specialists would feel very uncomfortable writing or saying in a public discourse, for example, a podcast like this one. And I think that's then, you know, very problematic.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, definitely the case of Hong Kong shows us, and a lot of the things going on in China, especially like the Uyghur population, shows that we do need to keep this discussion going. And it's not enough just to accept the legitimacy and as academics, you know, kind of stop the conversation. But there is a role.
Yeah, and also I think, I mean, the real dividing line, I think, is whether or not academics are socially engaged. I mean, there is, of course, an argument to be made for purely theoretical, you know, pie-in-the-sky research. You know, that's legitimate, so don't get me wrong. But I think in the case of mainland China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, you know, these autocratic systems have real-world implications for the population, and you know our empathy should be with the suppressed population, so to speak, to put it very bluntly, and our empathy should be with the autocratic elites. And my impression is that very often, especially in Germany, but also partly here in the UK and other places, a lot of folks try to explain, you know, why the Communist Party, you know, has to use draconian, like, you know, means to govern a big country like China with a huge population. These kind of very unconvincing arguments are being doled out, you know, quite frequently, actually. But, you know, another perspective would be to say, you know, there is official China and, of course, there's unofficial China, and we have to pay attention to both. And, you know, I have certainly paid more attention to what I call unofficial China, those independent-minded academics, activists, environmentalists, etc., who want to bring about change, because very often they are ignored, they are marginalized in the public discourse. People don't pay attention to them. And instead, they only talk about Xi Jinping, they only talk about the Communist Party, they only talk about official China. And I think this is a mistake, because it kind of portrays the Chinese state, but also Chinese society, as this monolithic block where there are no diverging opinions and interests, but nothing could be further from the truth. And so, you know, in terms of my own advocacy with this book, but also in my, you know, media engagement, public engagement, I always tried to make the point that let's not forget about unofficial China. And yes, it is being suppressed. You know, those civil society actors that I have worked with over, you know, the past 10, 15 years, many of them have been purged, and you know, some of them went to jail. But, you know, they exist. They have a very different vision for the country's future. And it's high time that we pay attention, you know, to what they say and think.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good reminder. It's very easy sitting in the liberal democratic West to just accept this official China narrative. But it's, I do think we should, as academics, as outsiders, you know, continue to question, continue to have these discussions, you know, and not take China as this monolithic block. So I think that's an excellent reminder. And that really comes through in your book, the significance for the people in China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong, and also the wider ramifications for the rest of the world. Andreas, just before you go, I'd just like to ask you what you're working on next.
Well, that's an excellent question. I mean, I've been like literally thinking about this book for 10 years. And I had been like procrastinating and thinking, you know, how can I tie all this together? So it's been, you know, a major project. And I'm glad I wrote this book. But of course, you know, it's not possible to just write another book of this caliber just straight away. So I think what I'll do, I have always had another strand in terms of my research interests. I have looked at, you know, how the West engages with China more broadly. I wrote my PhD about Sino-German Development Cooperation, and I have taught on EU-China relations. And given what happens in Hong Kong, given what has happened inside China, you know, in terms of the treatment or, you know, maltreatment of the Uyghurs and Kazakhs, one of my concerns is how can we, you know, toughen up, you know, Western China policy? How can Germany, how can the UK, how can Europe develop a more assertive China policy? So I think what I'll do is I'll probably write a book about this shift from what I call naive China engagement towards a more assertive China constrainment. And hopefully can write this, you know, fairly quickly to kind of document, you know, this rather monumental shift that's currently happening in terms of Western China policy, especially in Europe, because I think this is worth documenting. It's also worth discussing because, as we all know, now with the national security law, the so-called national security law in Hong Kong, one country, two systems is no more. You know, the civil and political liberties of the Hong Kongers are being stripped away. And there's a real danger now that Xi Jinping may move on Taiwan, that we may actually see a military annexation of Taiwan in the foreseeable future. At least that's more than a theoretical possibility. And this is something, of course, that, you know, Western liberal democracies will have to contend with and should think about and anticipate and hopefully, you know, do anything they can do to prevent that from happening. So I think this will be kind of the next big project, like a book on EU-China relations.
That sounds like essential reading for our times. I'll certainly, I know myself, I'll be looking out for it, especially building on your book, Democracy in China, Taiwan and Hong Kong. I mean, I found that like so invaluable. So yeah, I'll look forward to your new work. And just to recap, you've been listening to the New Books in Law, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Jane Richards, and I've been speaking with Andreas Fulda about his new book, The Struggle for Democracy in Mainland China, Taiwan and Hong Kong, Sharp Power in Its Discontents. I really recommend that you get a copy of it. It's so important to understand what's going on in the world now, what's going on in China and its periphery. You can catch Andreas on Twitter at @AMFChina. Andreas, thank you for your time.
Thank you again for having me.
Bye.
Bye for now.